Can social policies affect health? That is the question that my guests today, Emily Courtin of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine and Peter Munich of Columbia University, sought to answer in their June Milbank Quarterly article, which systematically reviewed all known randomized social policy experiments in the United States that involved interventions intended to improve health outcomes. I'm Alan Cohen, editor of the Milbank Quarterly, and in this episode of our podcast, Milbank Quarterly in Conversation, we'll be exploring their findings, which seem increasingly relevant in the context of the current COVID-19 pandemic. So let me direct the first question to you, Peter. What prompted you and your colleagues to undertake this review?
So I did a study a long time ago that found that poverty is associated with a larger burden of disease than smoking and obesity combined. And scientists have looked at a lot of correlational data showing that poverty is a huge predictor of disease and death. So tackling poverty is probably a pretty good place to start if you want to prevent disease and death. But correlational data is probably not enough to go on. There have been a number of experiments that show that welfare policies can reduce poverty, but it's probably not reasonable to make the leap to say, hey, you know, if we just spend more money on welfare, we'll solve the healthcare crisis. And another reason for being skeptical is that welfare policies tend to help people later in life, but poverty starts to take its toll in the womb. You know, there were just too few true experimental studies directly linking social policy to health. So we began to look at pure welfare experiments and stumbled upon a trove of health data that is sort of buried within these old welfare experiments. And we found a lot of these economic welfare studies do have good health data that had just not been previously looked at. We realized that there was enough information there for a meta-analysis, and we're really excited to put one together.
Thank you. Emily, what are your primary findings?
So as Peter just mentioned, the aim of this review was to try to capture all randomized controlled trials of social experiments that incorporated health outcomes since the 1960s in the US. So we ended up including 38 randomized controlled trials covering a wide range of interventions, early life and education policies, income maintenance and supplementation, welfare to work, employment, housing and health insurance. And I think there are three key takeaways. The first one is that if you look at the overall picture, what you see is that half of the estimates that we have collected demonstrated a significant positive effect on health. 44% had no effect on health, and 7% were associated with a significant worsening of health outcomes. Second, if you now zoom in on the studies which had a positive effect on health, there are three categories of interventions that really stand out. The first one is early life and education programs, and you can think of intensive early childhood prevention or preschool programs for children from low-income families. Those programs had positive effect on health outcomes across the board, including decades after the intervention itself was implemented. So those programs really seem to put children on a different path towards better socioeconomic outcomes and ultimately improved health outcomes as well. The second category of interventions that had a positive effect on health are income and supplementation programs, which were associated with improvements on a range of health outcomes, including self-rated health. And that was partially the case for conditional cash transfers, which are interventions that condition the receipt of cash on adopting health-promoting behaviors like going to school for kids or preventive care, for example. And finally, and perhaps unsurprisingly, health insurance interventions were also associated with consistent improvements in health outcomes. The most famous of these experiments, the Oregon study, showed improvements across a number of physical and mental health outcomes, for example. And the third takeaway of this review for me is that it's about the evidence that we are presenting in this paper. In many ways, it is almost as good as it gets in terms of the robustness of the design of those studies because we are focusing exclusively on randomized controlled trials. There is a number of limitations that we do need to keep in mind when we look at the evidence base that we have gathered in this paper. The first one is very important because it's the idea that most of those trials were not designed with health outcomes in mind. They were designed with education or unemployment in mind as primary outcomes. As a consequence, 3/4 of the estimates that we are reporting are actually underpowered to detect health effects if there is an effect. So to overcome this issue, we focused our reporting on those estimates which are actually powered for health outcomes. Second, the risk of bias related to the design of those experiments was high in half of the papers reporting findings from the 38 trials. So the quality of the evidence we have here is high, but as always, it is not perfect. And finally, we found evidence of publication bias, which means that statistically significant findings were considerably more likely to be published than null findings. So to overcome this issue, a lot of our efforts while we were working on this review went into trying to find unpublished reports that did not make it to the peer-reviewed literature. And I think it ended up being a unique strength of our paper that we went beyond this subset of randomized controlled trials that made it to the peer-reviewed literature to hopefully give a fuller picture to researchers and policymakers of the health effects of those social experiments.
Very interesting findings. That, of course, now begs the question of which social interventions had negative effects on health. Peter, would you like to respond?
Sure. So a big one of those is time limits on welfare programs. This is actually a study I did about a decade ago by linking the old welfare reform experiments to mortality data. And we sort of found that in these programs, deaths increased surprisingly, even as employment and income rose. And I have some speculation about why this is. You know, when Bill Clinton promised in welfare as we know it, it's my best impression of him. The idea was to move people off of welfare and into the workforce so they could earn benefits and work at the same time. And that program, known as Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, did help people enter the workforce. It did reduce the welfare rolls, and it did increase income on average. But some people just can't work. And these include people with, you know, big families, a sick relative that needs caregiving, people with mental health issues or physical health issues that don't qualify for a disability, and people without a car. And so when the time ran out after 5 years, some of them ended up homeless. And, you know, being homeless is probably not so good for you. So I sort of speculate that that's probably why we saw some excess deaths when we moved from the traditional welfare AFDC to TANF.
Well, Peter, I feel your pain. That's my best impression of Bill Clinton. So let me pose a question to both of you. What would you say are the key implications of your review for policy development, particularly for states or for nations? Who would like to respond?
I can speak to states. The implications are huge, especially in the United States, where we're very focused on cost efficiency and we have a polarized political environment. When a government decides to invest in welfare, it is much more likely to achieve something resembling bipartisan support when it's shown to be cost-effective. And it's really difficult to show that anti-poverty programs are cost-effective when you're only looking at economic outcomes, because you're basically just transferring money from the government to individuals. But it can make a big dent in our $1.5 trillion plus of government health expenditures in Medicare, Medicaid, and VA, and all of that. If it can make a big dent in that chunk of expenditures, then it's a whole different equation.
Emily, would you like to address the issue from the standpoint of nations?
I keep going back in my mind to these apparent double standards for the evaluation of interventions across different fields and disciplines. To give you an example, we would not introduce a new drug to the market without reliable evidence on its efficacy, potential side effects from a medical trial. And yet we do so repeatedly with social policies in the US and in many other countries. But just like drugs, these policies can have positive effects on health, but also negative effects that do need to be evaluated. They are also very costly. They require large investments and resources to be implemented. So we do need to get their design right. So what our review shows is that policymaking in this area does not need to happen in the absence of robust evidence. So in addition to what Peter already mentioned for the US, our review has implications for policymaking in many other high-income countries. Because there is still a reluctance to rely on randomization to evaluate interventions in Europe, for example. I also hope it will foster the development of this type of policy evaluation as I think that randomized control can offer clarity on the effect of social intervention on health in a way that other type of evaluation like quasi-experiments cannot offer.
Given the importance of economic policy, is it fair to say that good economic policy makes good health policy? Or in a COVID-19 world, does good health policy make good economic policy?
I might reverse that and say, you know, in a COVID-19 world, good economic policy especially makes for good health policy. There's a lot of evidence showing that these programs have the ability to reduce both the likelihood of getting a disease and the likelihood of having a less severe disease if you do get it. And the reasons for this are complicated, but they have to do with a lifetime of exposure to toxins, poor diet, and chronic activation of the fight or flight nervous system. And it's the wear and tear it causes on your immune system. There is a guy, Sheldon Cohen, at Carnegie Mellon, who has spent most of his life randomizing people to receive viruses or not. He just sort of injects them in their nose. And he found that low-income populations are much more likely to develop a cold if exposed to one and to develop a more severe symptoms. And also, he sort of follows this through the body, you know, from genes to the molecules to the cells to the organs, and finds that biological aging and wear and tear on the immune system is much greater in low-income populations. So if we can reverse some of those stressors, improve the diet, and reduce exposure to some of these toxic exposures, we're going to be a lot better prepared to fight a disease when we're infected by it.
Thank you. So it also leads to the question of, does COVID-19 make the need for these policies more urgent? What do you think?
Yes, I think it's absolutely the case. COVID-19 has brought total devastation in the labor market, as we know. The data we have shows that the coronavirus and the lockdown itself is affecting disproportionately low-income households and ethnic minorities. It was just estimated today by the Federal Reserve that almost 40% of those households making less than $40,000 per year lost a job in March. And those households who are living in poverty really face specific challenges trying to stay afloat during this crisis in face of rising unemployment and income losses. In addition, the services that they can usually rely on, like food banks, are likely to be severely disrupted at the moment, and they are more likely to not have or to have lost health insurance because they lost their jobs. So these are really times of unprecedented economic misery for a lot of low-income families in the US and across the globe. What is interesting in our review is that those populations who are currently the most at risk are the targets of a lot of those interventions. For example, a conditional cash transfer program like Family Rewards in New York or in Tennessee increased income and successfully reduced poverty while also improving self-rated health and mental well-being. So this is particularly promising in the current circumstances. On the contrary, adding time limits to welfare benefits might reduce reliance on welfare in the short run, increase unemployment, but it is also likely to have long-term detrimental effects on health, as Peter just explained. So what we hope is that this review will be useful for policymakers when they try to think about the different policy options that they have to try to support low-income households.
Yes, we can only hope that policymakers will pay heed to the findings from your study. So what is next in your research agenda?
So we're actually both working on some overlapping original randomized controlled trials of social policy that are designed to collect health outcome data. What we're hoping is to look at some much more intensive policies. One of them is called My Goals, and this is being conducted by MDRC, and it provides pretty large incentives for unemployed public housing recipients to enter the workforce and also to receive special coaching called executive function coaching that helps you set goals in life and keep them and manage emotional states and things like that. And we're excited to see what happens. This is a 3-year long intervention, and I think it's probably going to have some big health impacts.
Yeah, and I think one of the questions that is really driving our research agenda is to try to understand who might benefit the most from those programs. We are really interested in understanding how these different social policies impact differently the health of different population subgroups and trying to understand better when we should intervene, at which stage of the life of people, for how long, and when can we actually expect returns for their health.
Yeah, and bring it back to COVID-19. I think we're probably going to be adding some COVID-19 antibody tests and some questions to just see whether severity of disease was less in people who were treated with these welfare programs. I think that's pretty important because, you know, as we saw in Sweden, they just sort of kept everything open, everyone else around them locked down, and they didn't really need to flatten the curve because the population was so healthy. They got hit pretty hard, but the population was so healthy that they didn't see as many deaths as other countries did.
Well, that's very exciting. Good luck with your upcoming research. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us today. And thank you once again for your valuable contribution to the Milbank Quarterly.
Sure thing. Thank you so much for everything you've done for us.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.